This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
For this Thursday, September the 10th, this is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. I'm Steve Scully. We're glad you're with us. Here are some of your headlines. During a news conference and on Twitter, the president today trying to downplay some of the latest revelations in Bob Woodward's new book. This morning, at Real Donald Trump, he wrote the following, quote, "Bob Woodward had my quotes for many months. If he thought that they were so bad or dangerous, why didn't he immediately report them in an effort to save lives? Didn't he have an obligation to do so? No, says the president, because he knew they were good and proper answers. Calm, no panic." More just ahead. On Capitol Hill, Democrats blocking what some refer to as a skinny GOP COVID-19 bill. Another day of political debate with no results as negotiations remain stalled over a potential new round of federal assistance during this pandemic. Today's Senate development comes with new Labor Department numbers on the weekly jobless claims. They were worse than expected. The Labor Department reporting 884,000 first-time filings for unemployment insurance this past week. And out west, the wildfires continue to cause havoc across a number of states. The LA Times is reporting that in California alone, the fires have resulted in a dozen deaths, affecting more than 470,000 acres and destroying nearly 4,000 structures. The story shaping Washington today, it's all ahead on C-SPAN Radio. And we begin at the White House. Before heading to Michigan for tonight's campaign rally, the president held a mid-afternoon news conference. It included a lengthy statement off the top in which President Trump said that we are, quote, turning the corner on the pandemic and seeing an economic recovery into next year. After his remarks came a very direct question from ABC's Jonathan Carl on some of the newly released audio recordings that are the basis of Bob Woodward's new book titled Rage. Here is the entire five-minute exchange.
Why did you lie to the American people, and why should we trust what you have to say
now? Such a terrible question, and the phraseology, I didn't lie. What I said is we have to be calm, we can't be panicked. I knew that the tapes were there. These were a series of phone calls that we had, mostly phone calls. And Bob Woodward is somebody that I respect just from hearing the name for many, many years, not knowing too much about his work, not caring about his work. But I thought it would be interesting to talk to him for a period of, you know, calls. So we did that. I don't know if it's good or bad. I don't even know if the book is good or bad. But certainly if he thought that was a bad statement, he would have reported it because he thinks that, you know, you don't want to have anybody that is going to suffer medically because of some fact. And he didn't report it because he didn't think it was bad. Nobody thought it was bad. Wait a minute. And your question, the way you phrase that is such a disgrace. It's a disgrace to ABC Television Network. It's a disgrace to your employer. And that's the answer. Are you ready? Because
I didn't. Than the flu, and then you went out and told the American public that this was just like the flu.
We've had flu years.
And you told everybody else something else.
No, and five times, right? Five times. You ever hear the expression five times? We've had flu years where we lost 100,000 people. The flu is a very serious problem for this country also, and we've been losing them. Scott, what kind of a number have we lost over the years with flus? Into the hundreds of thousands?
Well, I mean, the last 5 years have been something like 35,000 to 80,000 per year, every year, even with antiviral drugs and even with
flu is a very serious problem. Also, but just so you,
this is worse than the most deadlier than the most strenuous flu.
Okay.
And then you went out and said it's just like the flu.
What I went out and said is very simple. Listen, what I went out and said is very simple. I want to show a level of confidence, and I want to show strength as a leader, and I want to show that our country is going to be fine one way or the other. Whether we lose one person, we shouldn't lose any, because this shouldn't have happened. This is China's fault. This is nobody's fault but China. China should not have allowed it to happen. Whether you have one person, 180,000 people, were 2.5 or 3 million people, which it could have been very seriously if we didn't make the moves. And when you look at the opposition, where they said, oh, why did he put the ban on? Dr. Fauci said we saved hundreds of thousands of lives by putting the ban on China and then ultimately putting the ban on Europe. There was no lie here. What we're doing is we're leading, and we're leading in a proper way. And if, frankly, somebody else was leading it, they wouldn't have closed it. If you look at Nancy Pelosi, you look at Cuomo, you look at de Blasio, you look at Biden, months later, they said there's no problem. They're talking about me. Months later, and before any statement was made, you have to remember, I put the ban on China. So obviously, outwardly, I said, it's a very serious problem. And it's always a serious problem. That doesn't mean I'm going to jump up and down in the air and start saying, people are going to die, people are going to die. No, I'm not going to do that. We're going to get through this, and we're right now, I hope, really think we're rounding the final turn. And a lot of good things are happening with vaccines and with therapeutics. But there's no lying. And the way you asked that question is very disgraceful. Phil, go ahead, please. Go ahead.
Yeah,
I do think so. I think we did a great job. And the people that did such our generals, our admirals, Mike Pence, all of the people that have worked so hard, and now Dr. Atlas, and all of the Dr. Fauci, Dr. Birx, they should be respected for the job they've done.
So you won't downplay it again, because you said you downplayed it. That's what you told me.
All I'm doing is, no, I don't want to jump up and down and start screaming death, death, because that's not what it's about. We have to lead a country. We're leading a great country, and we're doing a great job. And the people that have done such a good job should be given the kind of credit that they deserve. We possibly have done the best jobs when you start looking at what we're doing with the vaccines and therapeutics and ventilators. We had no ventilators, John. We make thousands of ventilators now a month, and we're supplying them to the whole world. The job we've done is the best job. And don't give me any credit. Give the people that have done this the credit. They've done a great job.
From today's White House briefing, again, the president with repeated questions from ABC's Jonathan Karl, who's out with a book on the Trump presidency. The president did conduct 18 interviews, mostly on the phone with Bob Woodward. A portion of those have been posted on the Washington Post website. And on the campaign trail in Miami, Democratic vice presidential nominee Senator Kamala Harris with this reaction.
On February 7th, the president of the United States, who has the unique and very important and special responsibility of concerning himself with keeping the American people safe, was in a conversation where he told, and we've heard that conversation, it's not like it's a narration of the conversation, we've heard it, said that COVID was deadly stuff, said that it is airborne. This is the same man, Donald Trump, who for days, weeks, if not months thereafter, called it a hoax, dismissed the seriousness of it to the point that he suggested people should not wear masks. He knew it was airborne, that people would breathe it. You know, Joe Biden said it well. He said, well, I guess we now know he knows how to read. He knew the facts of it. 5% potential lethality. He narrated all that in that conversation. In February and January, he had all this information, yet he held rallies. He suggested that to wear a mask is a sign of weakness as opposed to a sign of strength. This is the President of the United States.
That from Senator Kamala Harris, the Democratic VP nominee on the campaign trail with her husband in Florida. In a series of interviews on cable TV since the excerpts of the Woodward book came out, Speaker Nancy Pelosi has been very critical of President Trump, stating that he has, quote, total disregard for the toll on American families. And today, during her regular Thursday news conference, she had these comments.
What the president did showed, yes, in those comments, showed his contempt for the American people and their health, contempt for science, contempt for any real effort to crush the virus, contempt for his supporters, their children, their parents. He hid the facts and refused to take the threat seriously, leaving the entire country exposed and unprepared. He didn't want to cause a panic. Why? Because of the stock market? Nobody wants to cause a panic. You want to show leadership, show a strategic plan, following the science, allocating the resources in order to get the job done. Even now, he refuses to listen to science, which is just a tragedy.
That from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi on Capitol Hill earlier today. And on Fox News, Martha McCallum with the question that many in the White House may now be asking, why did the president agree to talk on the record with Bob Woodward? Here's that interview with White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows.
What was your understanding of how much access Bob Woodward had to the president? You're the chief of staff. Were you surprised to learn that he was on the phone with him for 18 hours, often late at night, making these recordings?
Well, I'm not surprised that the president was on the phone with Bob Woodward. His access to the White House is probably something that I would not have recommended had I been in the chief of staff role very early on. But it's the typical thing that the president does. He believes that he has nothing to hide. And that's the great thing about him is that he's willing to talk to anybody about any subject, no matter how difficult. He's probably given more interviews than any president in modern history, and it's all about making sure that the American people stay informed. Right. And whether you like it or not, he's willing to answer the difficult question.
That from Fox News and White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows. Well, in just a moment, we'll talk to CBS News White House correspondent Paula Reed. Earlier today, she filed this story on the Bob Woodward book, outlining what the president was saying publicly versus privately.
On February 7th, Bob Woodward spoke to the president, who had just talked with Chinese President Xi Jinping the day before. In audio recordings obtained by the Washington Post, Mr. Trump admitted to Woodward the severity of the virus.
It goes through air, Bob. That's always tougher than the touch. You know, the touch, you don't have to touch things, right? But the air, you just breathe the air, and that's how it's passed. It's also more deadly than your, you know, your even your strenuous flus. This is more deadly. This is 5% versus 1% and less than 1%. You know, so this is deadly stuff.
Our country is stronger today.
Even after acknowledging the virus was airborne, the president held at least 7 indoor rallies. And despite knowing the flu was not more deadly, Mr. Trump continued to say otherwise.
We're finding very little problem, very little problem. Now, you treat this like a flu.
By downplaying the threat, Americans lost time to prepare.
We're prepared and we're doing a great job with it, and it will go away. Just stay calm. It will go away.
Then in March, Mr. Trump told Woodward the virus was a threat to younger Americans.
Now it's turning out it's not just old people, Bob. Just today and yesterday, some startling facts came out. It's not just older.
Yeah, exactly.
Young people, to plenty of young people.
But then in the following weeks, the president was urging states and schools to reopen, saying this.
We'd like to see the schools open early next season and on time. It's incredible how it's very unique how the children aren't affected.
And in a shocking admission, on the same day the death toll in the United States reached 265, the president volunteered to Woodward that he was intentionally misleading the country.
Well, I think, Bob, really, to be honest with you.
Sure, I want you to.
I wanted to always play it down. I still like playing it down.
Yes, sir.
Because I don't want to create a panic.
One study from May estimates that shutdown delays in the early days of the pandemic could have cost up to 54,000 lives.
We would have had a stay-at-home mandate put in place, all of which we did, and we did it about as early as any American state, but we would have done it earlier and undoubtedly would have saved lives.
But on Wednesday, the president doubled down on his decision to lie about the severity of the virus.
The fact is, I'm a cheerleader for this country. I love our country. And I don't want people to be frightened. I don't want to create panic, as you say.
Mr. Trump's Democratic rival, former Vice President Joe Biden, blasted the president.
He knew how dangerous it was. And while this deadly disease ripped through our nation, he failed to do his job on purpose.
Joining us on the phone from the White House is CBS News correspondent Paula Reid. 24 hours after the first excerpts of this book released and your reporting earlier today, what kind of reaction has this been getting here in Washington?
Well, the bar is pretty high right now in Washington for anyone to be shocked. But this was truly shocking. The administration really had gotten to the point where they had been able to almost successfully change the conversation to the election, to the president's economic record, and to these larger questions about law enforcement, police use of force. But this book brings the conversation right back to COVID and how the president has handled it. And that's not good news for the president or his campaign, because our polls show overwhelmingly most voters do not think the president or his administration has handled this very well. And now if you pair these recordings, what the president says and then what he did, there are very legitimate questions about a cover-up that some people say cost tens of thousands of lives.
In the book, he's also talking about a weapon system, a nuclear weapon system that he said nobody has ever heard of before in this country. My question is, what does that mean for the U.S., for China, for Russia, and other adversaries?
Well, by putting this on the record in an interview with Bob Woodward, we've now put all of our adversaries, our allies as well, on notice about the system. So this is going to be something that's obviously going to be a target. This is not the first time the president has spoken out of school about very sensitive national security matters. It appears throughout these interviews that the president may have been trying to bolster himself, to maybe impress Mr. Woodward. But something like this is not what you share on the record with a reporter, knowing full well you're being recorded and it's going to likely wind up in a book.
All of this in the book by Bob Woodward. The title is Rage. As you know, he is facing criticism in some quarters for not releasing some of these recordings back in February and March, when potentially that information could have made a difference with regard to coronavirus.
It's a fair criticism. And the question is, do you have an obligation as a journalist, as a citizen, if you have evidence that the president of the United States may be downplaying, in his words, but others say misleading or outright lying about a deadly pandemic? Do you have an obligation to share that with the American public? Mr. Woodward is still associated with The Washington Post. It probably would not have been that hard for him to get some of this information out through other channels, even if he didn't release the audio recordings. He was asked about that yesterday by the Associated Press. He said that he wanted to vet the president's statements about the severity of the virus more thoroughly before releasing this information. He also defended himself, noting that he's not releasing this in December after the election. He's releasing it now, just several months after the fact. But it's not clear that that defense is really going to stop these questions. And interestingly, now the administration, the president himself, they're using this criticism of Woodward to defend the president. You saw the president tweeted earlier today, "Well, if what I said was so bad, why didn't Woodward share it?" And he's arguing that since Woodward kept it to himself, it couldn't have been that bad.
And, of course, that was part of the spin yesterday in your exchange with White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany.
That's right. They're insisting that the president didn't lie, that he just tried to downplay this and project strength. But when you look at what transpired here, you have the president telling Woodward in February that he knew this was airborne. Then he holds six campaign rallies. In March, he tells Woodward that this is transmissible among young children while he's pushing for schools. I don't think many people are going to say that's downplaying. It appears to be a deliberate effort to mislead the American public and potentially a full-blown cover-up. It wasn't even just the president. If you look beyond the Woodward book, we see the National Security Advisor, Robert O'Brien, according to the president, telling him in January, it's going to be one of the biggest national security threats you face. And then 5 days later, going on Face the Nation and saying, this is something that's low risk. It's a big question about how this administration handled it. They're saying that they were projecting confidence, other people suggesting that they cost tens of thousands of American lives.
We are talking with Paula Reid, White House correspondent for CBS News, and in the book, some very sharp criticism by the president's former defense secretary, General Jim Mattis, his former national director of intelligence, Dan Coats, and the current infectious disease expert at NIH, Dr. Anthony Fauci. Does any of this surprise you?
It does not surprise me. We know that the president and some of his former military leaders, they have exchanged criticisms. Many of the former military leaders who have worked under the president, once they've left, they've come out and been very critical of President Trump, of his command of world events, of his decision making. Fauci's a little more complicated because Fauci has denied Woodward's characterization of some of the comments that he made, specifically suggesting the president doesn't have much of an attention span, that he's only worried about getting reelected. Fauci's been asked about that yesterday, and he said that he does not believe that the president intentionally misled the public. That is a statement that is hard to believe, because if you look at what the president was saying, if you look at what's happened over the arc of this pandemic. But what I've seen with so many other officials in this White House is often officials, if they believe that being close to the president, being in the room where it happens, is the best way to serve their country, and if they believe that they can positively influence decisions, they will at times perhaps be willing to say things and defend the president when perhaps that's not necessarily what they truly think. But they want to preserve the access, not necessarily to the president, but to what they believe is really important decision making. And in this case, looking on the surface here, it appears that Fauci does not want to alienate the president, does not want to add to the criticism.
And finally, based on what you're hearing internally, what can we expect on Sunday when Bob Woodward is featured on CBS's 60 Minutes?
It'll be really interesting to hear the big question, why exactly did the president talk to you? How did you get him to open up? Why would he do this? Now, I don't expect that 60 Minutes is going to grill Bob Woodward on whether he should have released this earlier. The focus is really going to be on the president, on how he handled a lot of these questions. It's not just COVID either. It's also going to be questions about race and what the president said to Bob Woodward, arguably a peer, obviously both the same age, approximately the same race, the same sex, what he said to him about race relations in this country.
Paula Reed soon heading to Shanksville, Pennsylvania for tomorrow's 9/11 commemoration ceremonies, joining us from the White House. Her work available online at cbsnews.com and tonight on the CBS Evening News. We thank you for being with us.
Thanks so much.
By the way, Scott Pelley did conduct that 60 Minutes interview with Bob Woodward. It does air on Sunday, and the network releasing a portion of the segment, including this, focused on why the president withheld information from the public.
February 7th interview, it's clear that the president knows what the stakes are, but he's not sharing that with the public at that time.
Yes, this is the tragedy. A president of the United States has a duty to warn. The public will understand that, but if they get the feeling that they're not getting the truth, then you're going down the path of deceit and cover-up.
A preview of Sunday's 60 Minutes on CBS. Also, the president reportedly admitted to protecting Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman from congressional pressure following the death of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi. In one exchange, the president said, quote, "I saved his ass." The president reportedly spoke to Woodward after the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, where the author pressed him on Khashoggi's gruesome death inside the Saudi consulate in Turkey. Khashoggi, in his writings, a harsh critic of the Saudi government and the Crown Prince in particular. More from the president, quote, "I was able to get Congress to leave him alone. I was able to get them to stop," referring to the Crown Prince. According to the book, the president was concerned of the economic consequences of a congressional measure seeking to block an $8 million Saudi arms sale. Meanwhile, a large fire broke out this morning at Lebanon's main port in Beirut, sending up a plume of smoke near the site of a massive August 4th explosion that devastated a large part of the capital. People in the vicinity rushing to get away as firefighters tackled the blaze at a warehouse about 500 yards from the blast site. Today's fire, a grim reminder of the security lapses that led to the blast this past summer, which killed nearly 200, injured more than 6,000, leaving thousands of homes and businesses in ruins. According to the Wall Street Journal, a private contractor working in one of the warehouses, including welding, when the fire broke out earlier today. You're listening to Washington Today.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio. It's also available as a podcast. Here are some of your other headlines in campaign 2020. One battleground state will not have Kanye West's name on the ballot in a 7-0 ruling. The Ohio State Supreme Court determined that he was not eligible because the nominating petition did not match the petition signed by the voter. Kanye West has also failed to make the ballot in a number of other states, including Montana, West Virginia, and Wisconsin. He has also reportedly given up his request to be on the ballot in other states, including Arkansas, Idaho, Iowa, Tennessee, Utah, and Mississippi. More details at thehill.com. And tomorrow marks the 19th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks on this country. Politico is reporting that the Biden campaign is pulling all television ads tomorrow to commemorate the events from September 11th, 2001. The former vice president's decision, in line with long-running tradition of presidential campaigns, pausing ads on the anniversary of the terror attacks that killed nearly 3,000 Americans. And by the way, as you heard just a moment ago, we will have live coverage of the ceremonies, not only in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, but also in New York and at the Pentagon. Details at cspan.org. Now to Capitol Hill, where Democrats today blocking what was described as a pared-down GOP coronavirus relief bill. Today's vote leaving the two parties without a clear path forward to approve new economic stimulus before the November elections. The vote in the Senate, 52-47, far short of the 60 votes that would have been needed for the measure to advance. Democrats united in their opposition. Republicans voting in favor of it, all except one, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. We carried it live on C-SPAN 2. Here is Republican Senator John Thune of South Dakota.
Madam President, once again this week, Republicans are bringing forward a proposal to provide additional coronavirus relief to help protect jobs, to get kids and teachers back in the classroom safely, and to provide funding for the treatments and vaccines we need to defeat this virus. And once again, Democrats are objecting. It's the same old song. Republicans' bill doesn't spend enough. Well, let's talk about that for a minute, Madam President. First of all, Republicans are not claiming that the bill that we put on the floor this week contains the last dollars that we'll need to spend in response to the coronavirus. We may need to spend more. This bill is simply an attempt to direct relief funds to some of the biggest priorities right now, like helping the hardest hit small businesses weather this crisis and providing more resources for testing, treatment, and vaccines. These are areas, Madam President, that we should all agree on. Second of all, Democrats' coronavirus proposal, the $3 trillion bill that they proposed, is both unrealistic and irresponsible. Our nation is deeply, deeply in debt right now. Next year, our country will owe more than we produce for the first time since the end of World War II. That's a very bad place to be. That's getting toward the kind of debt-to-GDP ratio that helped bring about financial disaster in Greece. And while the United States is not Greece, if we grow our debt enough, what happened to the Greek economy could happen here. Being the United States of America does not exempt us from financial realities. Now, in times of crisis, sometimes you have to borrow money. And that's what we had to do earlier this year with the CARES Act and other coronavirus relief legislation. But, Madam President, we have an absolute responsibility to every American, to every hardworking individual in this country, to ensure that we are only borrowing what is absolutely necessary. And Democrats' proposal doesn't even come close to meeting the definition of necessary spending.
That on the Senate floor earlier today with John Thune of South Dakota. We learned yesterday, by the way, that we are facing a deficit this year in excess of $3 trillion, and the U.S. national debt now at $26.7 trillion. The failed Senate vote comes as Federal Reserve calling for more fiscal assistance to prevent the economy from sliding further this year. Many of the benefits approved by Congress in the $2 trillion CARES Act that passed in March have already run out. About 29 million Americans received some type of jobless aid just last week. More from the Senate floor debate. Here's Illinois Democrat Dick Durbin.
I can't tell you how many times back in Illinois during the August recess I was asked, so are you going back to Washington? And I said, yes, we're planning on going back in the first week in September. Well, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. At this point, there's been no negotiation and no compromise. Well, today we have a vote. We've been through this before. It is a McConnell proposal that was not put to any kind of bipartisan negotiation. It is a one-sided offering, and it fails in so many respects. Think if you are unemployed, trying to make your mortgage payments, car payments, medical bill payments, credit card payments, put food on the table, make sure the kids are ready to go back to school, and Senator McConnell announces, well, we're going to cut that check that you've been receiving for unemployment benefits in half. It won't be $600 a week. It'll be $300 a week. Why? For that family, their needs and their bills are still the same. The economy is still hurting with 30 million plus Americans out of work, 800,000 in Illinois receiving unemployment benefits, I'm sure thousands in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. And yet the reality is, what's going to be proposed by Senator McConnell today will create a hardship on these families they never envisioned. Is there any money in there to protect these families from being evicted? No. Wait a minute, how about food stamps and SNAP? Many of these families are struggling to put food on the table. Any help in this bill for them? No. Well, how about money for testing so that we can find out if people have positive results and should quarantine themselves and stay away from others? No. Not the kind of investment that is needed at this moment in history.
From the Senate floor earlier today with Dick Durbin, Democrat of Illinois, and joining us on the phone is David Drucker, a senior political reporter for the Washington Examiner. Bottom line, where does this put the Democrats, the Republicans, and the president?
Really good question, Steve. I guess it's sort of a case of choose your own adventure. House Democrats passed a pretty big bill a couple of months ago for another round of coronavirus relief. It was a non-starter for Republicans and the president. Then today, there was a unified Republican vote. Just one out of 53 Republicans voted against this slimmed-down version of coronavirus relief, and the Democrats filibustered it. They wouldn't let it proceed forward with debate, let alone agree to pass the bill. And so at the very least, Republican senators can at least go home, and especially Republican senators in tough races can at least go home and say, look, we, you know, a majority of Republicans and a majority, therefore, of the chamber at least voted to do something here so that we could move forward. Democrats weren't hearing about it. And Democrats are going to make the argument that they're not going to support a bill that is inadequate to the task. And clearly there's a lot of suffering going on still economically and from a health perspective in terms of the coronavirus. So, I think it's sort of going to be a matter of what audience you're playing to. I think Republican voters are going to look at the Democratic filibuster and blockade of this bill and decide they're at fault. I think a lot of Democratic voters are going to look at the Republicans' refusal to take up Nancy Pelosi's bill that passed in the House with a Democratic majority and find them at fault. And, you know, it's interesting whether or not the failure to get something done will hurt the president. You know, oftentimes voters don't pay attention to legislative procedure. All they want to know is, did you get something done? And if you didn't, then, you know, maybe we should get somebody else in there who can. On the other hand, sometimes these legislative fights are abstract, and a presidential campaign is about so many big issues, the coronavirus, of course, being one, the economy being another, that they're going to judge you on the merits of what they think you're trying to do, what they think you're capable of doing. And they're not necessarily going to blame you for some, you know, intramural fight going on in Congress. So I think we're going to have to see what happens over the coming days. I think part of this has to do with, you know, is the economy on a bit of an upswing based on the August jobs report? Or is it just treading water? Maybe it's not getting worse. Maybe it's not getting better. And then finally, you know, what happens with the virus in the weeks and months ahead? If there's a fall surge in cases and infection cases, that could be problematic for the president. But if the numbers, you know, continue to hold steady or decrease, and we don't have a situation like we had in the summer, then the inability to pass this bill may not loom that large. So I'm not really answering your question, but I'm saying these are a menu of answers to your question that you can choose from, and that might turn out to be true depending on how things unfold. as we go forward.
But as the president enters the home stretch of this fall campaign, he has not, for a number of reasons, been part of these negotiations, most notably with House Democrats Nancy Pelosi and Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer. Again, there have been a number of reasons. Does that, though, hurt the president, the perception that he has not been part of these talks?
Well, it could. But I think that what's hurting the president in a larger sense is just the fact that voters broadly are not satisfied with his management of the pandemic. I think if voters had felt that he had done a better job of reacting to the pandemic and handling it, I don't think they would be that concerned with a coronavirus relief package that is, you know, before Congress in the fall. I think one of the things that is protecting the president from too much blowback here, at least at the moment, is that he did work successfully with Democrats and Republicans in Congress and them with him on passing, three rounds of coronavirus relief, a quick bill, a massive bill, and a follow-up, or at least two. And I'm losing count here because of all of these months locked in my house. But it's not like the president has not done anything. The president and the Congress moved pretty quickly to do some pretty big things, approving more money in a relief bill than possibly has ever been done before. So the president can point to that, and it happened at a time when it was particularly crucial. That doesn't mean that he won't pay a price for this. I mean, we could get deeper into September, into October. Things are not any better. Things are worse. And people start to say, well, what have you done about it? Why haven't you worked with congressional leaders to figure it out? After all, you're supposed to be the big deal maker. I'm just saying, I think right now, whether or not that turns out to be the case is unclear, may not. And this campaign is about issues related, but larger than just one bill. And clearly here, Democrats aren't feeling the political pressure to cave either. Nancy Pelosi hasn't indicated that she's willing to take up the Senate Republicans' latest proposal. She wasn't willing to take up their last proposal. Of course, neither were Senate Republicans. They were divided, and that was part of the problem. But the Democrats in the Senate clearly felt confident enough to block this. They were willing to take on charges from Republicans that they're filibustering and standing in the way of progress because they feel like they have the political upper hand, and they feel like the bill simply wasn't good enough. But they didn't feel pressure, my point is, to say, well, it's not good enough, but it's better than nothing, so we'll do it. So everybody's sort of in a corner here.
So very quickly, you don't expect anything before Election Day.
Well, I didn't say that. It just depends on conditions. Nobody feels right now enough political pressure to move off of their position. Senate Republicans and the president did not feel enough pressure such that they were going to get behind Nancy Pelosi's bill, the House Democratic bill that passed with a Democratic House earlier in the year. And Senate Democrats do not feel sufficient pressure to support the latest Republican proposal. But let's see where things are. If things take a turn for the worse, if political conditions change, you could start to see people stray out of their partisan camps and demand more progress. It does, though, get very difficult because the closer you get to an election, there's a lot of partisan pressure back home not to abandon your team. You know, politics, especially these days, has become really a shirts and skins sort of a game. And so it's not just about whether or not you're getting something done. Voters, particularly your voting base on the right and the left, it's about not hurting the team, damaging the other team, about not just getting anything done, but only getting that done which you think is best. And so there's not a lot of reward for compromise at this point in the election cycle. And, you know, quite frankly, there's often not a lot of reward for compromise at any point in the election cycle. But we'll have to see where things are with the infection rate and economic conditions, you know, let's say a month from now.
And we'll follow the details at WashingtonExaminer.com. David Drucker, senior political reporter, we thank you for being with us.
Anytime. Thank you.
At the closing bell on Wall Street, the Dow losing more than 400 points, the S&P off by nearly 60, and the Nasdaq dropping 222 as the tech sell-off continued today. The Washington Post is reporting that teachers in a number of states have died from COVID-19 since the fall semester began just a few weeks ago. At least six educators from Iowa, Missouri, Mississippi, Oklahoma, and South Carolina have died since early August. This as students return for the school year. The deaths of these teachers come as many schools across the country reported for in-person classes or virtual classes or a hybrid program after shutting down in the spring because of the pandemic. The decision, of course, whether to reopen is at the discretion of state and local officials. More details at WashingtonPost.com. In campaign 2020, a newly released ad by the Lincoln Project comparing South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham to parasites for his relationship with President Donald Trump. It's an ad often using some gruesome images. It's the latest attack ad from a group of disaffected Republicans. Senator Graham is facing a challenge from Democrat Jamie Harrison this November.
Some animals can't survive unless they take. They don't establish natural equilibriums. Some animals are parasitic. They drink the lifeblood of their hosts, infect whatever they touch, and spread like a virus. They're often right under our noses, camouflaged, convincing their hosts they're not harmful at all.
And every time I turn around, I'm being asked about Donald Trump.
He's crazy.
He's a race-baiting, xenophobic, religious bigot.
He's unfit for office.
And when their host is taken from them, they seek a new one.
I am all in. Keep it up, Donald.
Everything he said was true.
Parasites don't care if they feed off a good host.
I love him to death.
Or an evil one. They only have one purpose: to feed. There's only one way to stop a parasite: deprive it of its host.
That ad from the Lincoln Project. Meanwhile, the Trump campaign out today with this new spot.
From the very beginning, Democrats, the media, and the World Health Organization got coronavirus wrong. The World Health Organization said authorities have found no clear evidence of human-to-human transmission.
Overall, most people should not be terribly concerned about it.
Everything is fine here. We do want to say to people, come to Chinatown. Here we are. Come join us.
We don't even think it's going to be as bad as it was in other countries.
Go about your lives. Go about your business.
One leader took decisive action to save lives. President Donald Trump. Banning travel from China and coronavirus epicenters, Biden charged xenophobia. But President Trump was right. Signing the CARES Act, providing immediate relief to American families, workers, and businesses, declaring a national emergency, tapping into $42 billion in existing emergency funding, quickly getting crucial personal protective equipment to the states, signing the Families First Coronavirus Response Act, ensuring that American families and businesses impacted by the virus receive the strong support they need, launching Operation Warp Speed to fast-track a vaccine in record time.
He said everything that I could have hoped for. Promise made, promise kept.
He is ready, willing, and able to help.
He has been responsive. He's done a lot of good things.
What the federal government did was a phenomenal accomplishment.
In our hour of need, you all literally are helping us in a big way. We were at the edge, and this is life or death stuff, and we're forever thankful for that.
Soon, we will emerge safer, stronger, and greater than ever.
That from the Trump campaign. According to RealClearPolitics.com, the Biden campaign is ahead in six key battleground states. The focus tonight, Arizona, Florida, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. In each of those states, the Democratic nominee, the former vice president, is ahead between 4% and 6%. Meanwhile, ABC News is reporting that attorneys for President Trump's reelection campaign urging a federal judge in Las Vegas to block a state law and prevent mail-in ballots from going out to all active Nevada voters. The action coming, of course, less than 8 weeks before the November 3rd elections. And on our podcast, The Weekly, we talked to Newt Minow. He has been part of the presidential debate process since the first televised debates back in 1960 between John Kennedy and Richard Nixon. He's the author of a book on the process, a member of the Commission on Presidential Debates, and he offers these thoughts on how the debates are run and how we elect our president.
I would change everything. I would change so we went to a system as is true in most other countries where candidates cannot purchase time. The time is allocated as a public service by broadcasters, and that we would take a lot of the money out of politics. That's the first thing I would do. And I would have more debates rather than less.
Has the FCC changed since you served in the early 1960s, and if so, how?
Well, it's changed, I think, greatly. The main thing is the technology has changed. And as a result, the Internet, rather than broadcasting, is occupying more of the most of the FCC's attention and time. And the Internet is presenting many perplexing, difficult regulatory problems that we haven't solved yet.
Because, as you know, everyone can have an opinion, express their views on social media and on the web. So is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, it's a good thing, except it seems to me that there's a very big danger that we can have foreign countries, particularly the Russians, interfering in our elections by misleading people.
More of our conversation with Newt Minow. He is our guest on C-SPAN's The Weekly. The podcast is easy to get. You can check it out at cspan.org/podcasts. For this September 10th edition of Washington Today, I'm Steve Scully. Thank you for listening. We're back tomorrow.
C-SPAN's Washington Journal. Every day we're taking your calls live on the air on the news of the day, and we discuss policy issues that impact you. Coming up Friday morning, New York Daily News reporter Larry McShane on today's 9/11 commemoration in New York City. Then counterterrorism analyst Thomas Anderson talks about evolving threats facing the U.S. homeland as the nation commemorates 19 years since the September 11th attacks. Watch C-SPAN's Washington Journal, live at 7 Eastern, Friday morning. Be sure to join the discussion with your phone calls, Facebook comments, text messages, and tweets.